want insight and solutions? You're in for a unique experience, one where you're free to ask questions about where you're stuck, ask and hear questions of an everyday variety, global or personal, deep or ancient. All questions are welcome. Any human issue or problem is seen with a new awareness from Patricia's powerful understanding of whole brain thinking. Receive insights you never thought were possible, and be comforted to hear some insights you always knew were right. Discover the profound and the creative value that problems can give us. And now, Patricia Sun.
Welcome to Trust the Problem. And today on Trust the Problem, I'm going to do a show that's inspired by Al Gore's new movie, An Inconvenient Truth. And that's such a lovely phrase in our world these days, since we live by so many inconvenient truths, or ignore so many, probably the better way, we live accommodating, not looking at them. So there's another side to inconvenient truth, and sometimes it's difficult to tell, because really, it's about balance, and I think of Al Gore's first book, Earth and the Balance. It was a wonderful book, and it's just astounding to me the intelligence and the capability there that kind of got put down during media coverage in the elections. Having a degree myself in conservation and natural resources, I understand why it is hard, because I've thought about it a long time, why it is hard for people to do things that are environmentally sound. It just feels so overwhelming or impossible. And one of the things that I've heard Al Gore say, I heard him give a talk, and I think it's in his movie also now that I think about it, but he used to say something similar to what I would say, in that when you start to look at things, the people have sort of two reactions. Well, first reaction is denial. It's too overwhelming. When we first have to look at the truth about something, we just don't want it. It's an inconvenient truth, so we don't want to look at it. And then, when we start to use our integrity and our intelligence and experience, and we begin to see certain things are true that we don't want to look at, then we sometimes shift very quickly to a kind of despair. And that dynamic of denial and then despair is a symptom of what I call old-style thinking. Now, old-style thinking is either or. Either we have to deny it, or we have to see it, and then it's too much, it's overwhelming, and we have to despair over it. And what I've always said is, what I like to do and what I teach is building the space, building the territory between denial and despair. And what happens if you start to build the territory in there, you become creative and you start to see things you didn't see before. It's actually very liberating. And this is true of all problems, not just global warming. And it's one of the reasons, too, why I always have stressed solving problems at the source, the closer to where the problem is beginning, the easier it is to correct, which also helps on that despair issue, and takes us out of denial quicker, because the quicker we're out of denial, the sooner we will be processing and brainstorming and being creative and being synergistic and working towards solving a problem. And as you know, Trust the Problem is dedicated to solving problems, because solving a problem is a creative force in the universe. It's our ability to use our greatest gift as human beings to solve problems. And of course, our greatest gift is a combination of two things. It's the creativity to invent, to think of things never thought of before. But the great part of that gift is to be able to do it with love, to be able to do it with goodwill. This is what truly creates balance, is when you can brainstorm or think of or contemplate or reveal to someone an issue tell the truth with love, with kindness. This is the crucial ingredient. When we're immature thinking, when we're linear thinking, and we say tell the truth, we can get nitpicky, we can say things that are injurious, that are insulting, that are even inappropriate in their isolation, even if they are true. So we need to be shifting to this new style of thinking, which allows you to use your intuition, which holds the new thought, the creative new insight, because you have a problem. And the right brain also, the intuitive mind, also is the place of generating emotion and love. And it is also the place of the overview, seeing things, how they're connected, that is not linear, that is not directly connected, and spiritual knowledge and spiritual experience. So this is what the evolutionary leap is when we are maturing our intuitive mind in that way, and when we are maturing our logical mind in the way of not needing to be right all the time, not having that emotional guard and filter, making the intuitive emotional energy serve looking right, rather have it serve being good. And this is a new kind of thinking. That's what I've always said. It's much more powerful to be good than to be right. And it is a shift in the mind's focus that lets you use both hemispheres at the same time. This is an evolutionary leap. This is a new kind of thinking. This is something that only we can create by observing ourselves and choosing it. I'll say that again. We are the only ones who can create it. And you personally, your body, your life, the episodes of your existence, the problems you face, are unique in the universe and are a certain matrix of material, almost, of data and experience, that if you personally observe it with this new filter of, it's too trite to say win-win, because that's used a lot and it's good. It's a good thing. It's just that it's deeper than that. It's a really profound manifestation of capability, how you let your mind and your brain have a new premise or software from which to function and integrate. And that's the evolutionary leap. That's the new style of thinking. And for many decades, many, many years ago, I can't even say this, when Nixon opened the door with China, there was a thing that I discovered about the ancient Chinese ideograph for crisis was a combination of danger and opportunity. And that what a crisis is a moment of great power where you can let go of the old style thinking, the rigidity or the blind spots or the either or the powerlessness or the despair, any of those things that polarize it into those two, you know, need for denial or despair. You jump the track out of that. You build a new center because the crisis wakes you up. Another analogy, which Al Gore also mentions in his movie, An Inconvenient Truth, which is a wonderful, wonderful film. I'll talk about it a little bit more as we go along. I really recommend you see it. And bring a friend or a neighbor. And bring a young person. You know, bring a teenager. But anyway, one of the things that he mentioned was an analogy that was prominent a very long time ago, about a frog, and if you put a frog in boiling water, it feels it and it just leaps right out. But if you put a frog in a bucket of lukewarm water and you just very slowly, by slow increments, bring it to a boil, the frog is cooked to death. It doesn't sense it. The small increments are sort of under its threshold, and it's immobilized and literally cooked before it. Well, it never really sort of realizes it's dying. And that's a powerful metaphor for our choices and why crisis and problems are so valuable, because that's the boiling water. That's the water saying, ouch, you know, that's the situation, the issue, the problem that is making you say, wow, I don't like this. This is something bad here. Something's not working. And it makes you move. And there's times for moving and there's times not, you know, for moving. So it's not that. It's just that crisis is valuable. So what is beautiful about this time right now is that not only are we in a global crisis of climactic and climatic proportions, we are reaching this kind of crescendo threshold of not being able to be old-style thinkers anymore. We're doing it in terms of creating war. We're doing it in terms of pandemics. We're doing it, of course, to the environment, which has so many, the environment is everything we live in. And so it covers everything we're doing in business and in how we supply energy, and the whole issue, of course, of global warming as a, it's like the Earth has a fever. And, you know, I remember when I was a little girl and my father used to, one of my wonderful things about my father, probably the thing I loved most about him, my favorite issue was, or way that he was, is that he was very smart, he was self-educated, and whenever I asked a question, he gave me a really deep answer, and he often gave me a scientific answer. And he gave me one that helped me understand. And so when it comes to the Earth warming, it's like it having a fever. And I remember, I don't know if he told me or he just set me up to ask the question or notice the answer, but fevers exist to kill bacteria, kills off certain kinds of bacteria that can't live in that high temperature that your body does. And that's why your body goes, you know, big flash, high fever. And, of course, we've always thought fevers is detrimental, which when they're very, very high, of course they are. But for the most part, they serve a purpose, and we always rush to, like, bring down the fever. And that's simplistic thinking, again, that we use in our medical profession, you know, that the fever's not bad because if it's too high, it isn't good. It causes brain damage and other things, especially in small children. But on the other hand, having a fever is the body's defense mechanism for killing off certain bacteria and is not so bad a thing if it doesn't last too long or go too high. So, and you could always put cool cloths on your forehead to keep your brain cool, or on your neck, keep the blood cool that goes to your brain. So when you understand the whole picture, then problems become different. So the problem isn't that you have a fever. The problem is, what is the fever doing and how do you assist it so that it does the right thing at the right time? And that's why knowledge is so important. This is the logical linear mind. You need facts. You need data. And if you're in denial, you don't want to hear it. And if you're even in despair, sometimes you don't want to hear it. So one of the real barriers to our consciousness, to our waking up and becoming whole and growing up and being mature and being the full potential that we have as Homo sapiens, the brains we have, to be able to really use them, we have much personal work to do to not be the bacteria on the planet that the Earth has to destroy. To continue to live. And that was the analogy I was getting to. It's almost as though the Earth is having a fever from what we're doing. Of course, we're doing it. We're making it happen, as well as the natural cycles compounding it. Then, the other thing is that the Earth is, that I remember Al Gore mentioned this also in a talk I heard, and I think it's in the movie also, and it struck me so deeply when I first heard him say it at this lecture he was giving in San Francisco. And it was that because of the way the weather works and the tilt of the Earth to the sun, it's as though with the seasons, the earth breathes in and out. It's the way the water currents warm in the ocean, and the shift as the earth tilts, where and how what warms, and it creates this almost pulse. And I think of it as a heart heartbeat or a breath. a heart breath. I think of it as both. I think of it as the two together. That it is the pulse of life of our planet. It's about it's a yearly pulse, and we, when we can look at this overview, we can see this bigger picture. Then we're using that whole brain thinking. We're using all those facts accumulated, and then we let the intuitive mind have that spatial whole visual hit about how they're all connected. Way beyond any linear connection, but from an overview. This is why problems are so valuable, is because they keep setting us up to do that, to stop for a moment and contemplate and pause and get the overview. And one of the things about this climate problem is that it affects every living thing on the planet. It affects us all. It is no longer something, a catastrophe in the Brazilian forest cutting down trees. It's not a thing. It's not in an area removed from us or a problem removed from us. This is a global unifier. This is the opportunity, the wonderful, beautiful opportunity inside the crisis. And the danger calls us together because as we pull together, as we don't think us and them, as with my T-shirts that I have, my logo, the picture of the earth and the words go around, you can't take sides when you know the earth is round. And what happens is that each letter stands like a person on the earth, upright. But when you look at somebody who's wearing the T-shirt, you can see the upper part. You can't take sides when. You know the earth is round, it's upside down to you. But if a person wearing it looks at it, it's the reverse. For them, the letters, you can't take sides, is upside down, and when you know the earth is round, is right side up. I have the shirt on, so I'm just looking down at it. So what happens, and why I got that. I mean, I asked for it from my intuitive self one night. I went to bed. I said, I want something that joins the linear mind, the logical, linear, verbal mind, the left brain, and the right brain, which is the intuitive, acausal, spatial, whole, visual mind. I want something that joins them together and helps us mature in the direction we're maturing. And I woke up with this vision in my head of the earth and the words going around it. Well, you can't take sides when you know the earth is round. And it's not even round a circle, it's round a sphere. So it's a hologram. So there are all kinds of dualities, but the whole is much more than the sum of the parts, that old saying. And so this is the leap. This is the philosophical, intellectual, psychological, spiritual revelation of new style thinking, of this evolutionary leap. And I've been teaching that we're in the midst of an evolutionary leap for 35 years. Every time I did a workshop, I started it with, I believe we are in the midst of an evolutionary leap. And it is one of consciousness. It is one of capacity to perceive. So our capacity is expanding from linear to holographic, from sequential to the whole. And that's why I first started teaching holistic thinking, holistic health, and tried to have people understand the mind-body-spirit connection in healing. It's all of one piece, and it's happening now. And when I started some 35 years ago, and then about 5 years after into it, I had a very strong premonition that maybe it'll take 20 years from now. Maybe it was supposed to take 20 years from then that we would hit this place now, where, even though it's 30 years, it took a little longer. Because we can resist if we want to. But we can also create if we want to. And we the one reason I always say it's we're maturing is because literally I believe as a species we are integrating something that was beyond our capacity because of the youngness of our species. We literally were young, immature in the kindest, truest, authentic use of the word, and just not physically able yet to handle it all. And we're still in a kind of adolescent crisis, or I don't know, toddler crisis. I don't know where exactly the metaphor would fit, but we are in a crisis of shifting our perception to include a bigger view. And the big deadlock on that, the thing that ties us up and stops us from doing that, is our style of thinking that says either or, either you're right or you're wrong, and the conditioning we've had that you might as well be dead if you're wrong, that it's so bad to be wrong, which is a kind of ludicrous kind of thought, the idea of it being bad to be wrong. And we can't even go there. We can't even consider that it's bad to be wrong. It's bad to continue to do things that are harmful when you know better. Well, yeah. But that's not exactly a mistake. A mistake is when you try something, a mistake. You try it, you take it, you look at it, you do it, whatever, and you see it doesn't work. But more importantly, when you make a mistake, you try something, and if you really are looking, you see parts work and parts don't work. And then some parts just are. You just gain some information. In fact, that's the vast majority of it. It's not so much that it works or doesn't work. It's just there. And you just get some information. And the value of having a consciousness that encourages and is free to make mistakes is that you adventure into doing something, to seeing how things work. And you can self-correct at the source very quickly. And then the mistake is just growth, and absolutely essential to the growth. One of the things I always like to say when I talk about this is that, you know, when you make a mistake, I think it was Henry Ford that said, oh no, it was, I always mix these two guys up. It was Edison, Thomas Edison. He said, when you the person who makes a mistake, I forgot the exact quote, but the punchline is the person who makes a mistake knows 100 things the person who never made a mistake doesn't know. And what they know are all the things that don't work. And it's as valuable information to know what doesn't work and why, even more valuable, and what part doesn't work and why, even more valuable. So to make a mistake and observe it and contemplate it and consider it and reflect on it and talk to people about it and brainstorm on it to see why it was a mistake is very, 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 very valuable and very much part of trusting the problem and very much part of the new style of thinking that we're trying to invent. If we try to nail down the answer too soon or too fast, what happens is that we can't contemplate. We can't do the next many steps of creation and discovery. And the only thing that makes us want to nail it down too fast is the psychological desire, the conditioning from our world and our family, that we need to be right. Needing to be right is really a problem. You know, it's its own reward when you do something good or you do something, quote, right, and it feels great. And you discover discover it, that's nice, and other people see it, that's nice too, but it is way skewed, and it is causing devastating problems. And it's interesting that the administration that we have in the United States right now, the federal administration, is very much epitomizing that old-style thinking. It's almost as though it is serving us all by being there for us to really look at, not just be the frog in the warm water, but really get it. Wow, this is making a big mess after big mess after big mess. And I don't think it's because they're just like people, like they're bad people or something. I think it's a thinking problem. I think it's a psychological problem. I think it's an immaturity problem. It's even not really a political problem, though it's made one because it deals with politics. It is a thinking problem, and when we start to see that it's a thinking problem, then there are no enemies. There are no people to hate. There are thinking styles to correct and to manifest within yourself, to do yourself, to manifest yourself. So you have that power, and you facilitate wondrously other people doing it when you do it sort of in front of them or around them. Because one of the things that's left out, and this is so important, one of the things that's left out in our analysis, in our knowledge, because we're immature and because we fear psychic energy or emotional energy or even love, which is the most powerful psychic energy we have, and we fear it because we long for it, we need it, we want it, and in the name of it, using that word, people have violated us and violate themselves, and we see that, and we're sort of socialized in that confusion. Now, the good news about this is that it is just a socialization, and it can be undone. And the better news is the process of undoing it opens your mind, opens your heart, heals your body, transforms you, and does the thing that so many people are seeking, enlightenment, happiness, well-being, creative power. It does that. It creates that. So going through the process, whether it's global warming, the big, big, big picture, or it is the small picture of you battling yourself inside yourself to heal a wound, a defense mechanism. All of this is related. All of this is part of that bigger whole, that bigger piece, that more than the sum of the parts, that sets up a new state. So it's not only more than the sum of the parts, a new state of being is set up, which allows for more emotional energy, spiritual energy, mental energy as thought, as a communication. It allows more creativity. It allows, remember, I always describe creativity comes out of, you know, genius is the thinking something never thought before. And that's true creativity. Creativity isn't just getting the right answer. Creativity is creating options that didn't exist before. And that's why the word genius comes from Genesis, which means creation. Out of nothing, something. A vibration created it. The word was spoken. And the word and the matter together created light, and the word, the matter, and the light together created the heaven and the earth. And that's the statement. That's the metaphorical intuitive knowledge, spiritually known, yet not understood because there were so many missing pieces about how the earth works and about time and the ages of evolution of the planet and even the evolution of life in ourselves. You know, there's no conflict. There's just no conflict between evolution and the Bible. It's such a silly fight over nothing. Because if you go deep enough into the Bible and big enough into what it is metaphorical intuition. It is parable, as Jesus said, that all the great truths are spoken in parable, as Buddha said, I think. This is something that is the intuitive mind generating an image before it exists literally, so we can conceive of it and create in it. And as Abraham Lincoln said at the time of slavery and the political, psychological madness of the world we were in, the denial, the incredible denial, and that even the despair of slavery. And he said, we have to disenthrall ourselves. We are enthralled with delusions of power and our narrow view. And we have to disenthrall ourselves and do what is good for its own sake. Because when we do what is good for its own sake, we release a power in our intelligence. We create another dimension to our intelligence. It isn't just emotional intelligence. It is a creative power to generate something that didn't exist before. Because you're open to considering something good could come into being. And you keep accurate track, linear mind, mature linear mind, keep accurate track of facts, the data, the happenings, the events, the injuries, the unfolding, the beauty, the successes, the lack of success, and why. Contemplate why was something not a success. That's why a two-party system is so foolish. As George Washington, I think he said, it brings out the worst in human nature. In his farewell address, he really, really almost pleaded through several paragraphs that we not have just a two-party system, because it's dualistic thinking and it makes things overly simplistic. And we keep throwing the baby out with the bathwater on both sides. So, as Al Gore said, this global warming issue is not a Democrat-Republican issue. It's not a political issue in that sense. It's a political issue in the sense that it is public good and service and connection. And that's what politics meant and should mean. And we've lost its meaning, because we've lost its meaning. We've lost the capacity in our polarizing, in our throwing things out, in our throwing the baby out when we see dirty bathwater. We keep hurting ourselves. This is what old-style thinking does. We are in the midst of an evolutionary leap, and it is one of consciousness. It is one of a capacity to perceive. And the way we get it is living on the growing edge. The growing edge is a term I used to use exactly in this context. To create, to allow to come into being, the evolutionary leap. We allow a state of mind which lives on the growing edge, takes the edge in a growing way, the way one cell grows on top of another as a root grows deep into the earth for a big, mighty oak tree. When it starts as a little seedling, and even when it's very large, all the new roots that are coming into being, it's one little cell, double, you know, it grows, it splits from another, it grows, and it's little, and it grows bigger, and it tacks on in front one of the other, and they work their way around the little grains of sand and soil, and eventually boulders, and works their way around it or in between a fissure in a boulder and cracks the boulder. So this soft, gentle, one step, one cell at a time process creates the stability and the nurturance and the sustenance of a great oak tree. This is the same parable metaphor for our healing ourselves, for pioneering new thought, for breaking down something that seems like an obstacle that doesn't need to be, to work around it, to continue to grow, to not stop. Because old-style thinking is stifling, stagnant, and I always used to like to say the only way to have certainty is to be dead, because then nothing's happening. You're not contemplating it anymore. Because the only thing, and it's an ancient Greek phrase, it's been around a very long time, before even the ancient Greeks, the only thing certain in life is change. So living on the growing edge lets you participate with that change with goodwill and with an open mind and opened eyes and the capacity, the uniquely human, great genius gift to contemplate it. So to get facts, actually, and contemplate it with intuition and to contemplate it with visualizations, letting things come to you, like you can't take sides when you know the earth is round, when you let that just come, you couldn't invent it. In fact, that is how we really, truly invent things, is we let them come. Abraham Maslow, as I said before, who studied creative people, one of the main things he came away with was that what creative people do is they gather lots of data and then they go fishing, metaphorically speaking. They go do something mindless. Or they have a dream and it pops up. The answer just comes. This is the intuitive mind. This is right brain thinking. Things just come. And in our immaturity and in our superstitious immaturity, we are afraid of things we can't control. And we're afraid of things that just come, because where did they come from? Well, they come from whatever you choose it to come from. If you're thinking in fear and demons and devils, well, you get pretty narrow views. And fear-driven, fear-ridden, mean views. If you come from inspiration and you say, what's a good, wholesome, energetic response to this? Then you come from heaven. Then you come from inspiration. You breathe in spirit. That's what inspire means. Spire is the Latin for breathe. And the ancients believed that breath was spirit. It's why we say God bless you when you sneeze, because in the Middle Ages, when you sneezed, people thought your spirit popped out for a moment. And they wanted to bless you before a bad spirit could get in. So cultures that are always worried about demons and devils and goblins and things that go bump in the night are cultures that collectively have an immature, intuitive mind with much injury and fear and not knowing how to process that in a contemplative way that creates good. That's why there is a new consciousness being born beyond duality. And that's why polarized thinking, while great for observing, you know, this thing against that thing, then you have to stop and get the overview. So you basically do this thing against that thing, basically to see, well, what's the good point on the left side and what's the good point on the right side? And then you take out the good points and you create a new point of view that takes the best of both sides. That's why you don't take sides. You support all sides. You look for the good in all sides. You empower the good in all sides. And this is really earth in the balance. This is that next step. This is the environmental, spiritual, intellectual, political union. This is the consciousness of the evolutionary leap when we realize, Homo sapiens realizes, one, we really can solve problems. Two, we know the yardstick. It's what's good and what's wholesome. And three, we're really all connected, so we might as well use our abilities and our talents synergistically. Well, what? Create heaven on earth? Why not? It'll always be being updated. It'll always be changing. We'll always have a problem. But it will be the problems will be looked at as healing, creative sparks for the next level of being. And this is what the evolutionary leap is, and why our relationships, the problems we have, men and women have together, friends have, parents and children, children with their parents, employers, employees, employees with each other, politics, medicine, healthcare, legal system, penal system, all of the institutions are operating at the pretty much lowest level they could operate, because the collective consciousness is still functioning from greed, from needing to be right, from power over, from simplistic narrow view. So what is obviously, for instance, in medical terms, I used to think years ago, why do they make doctors who are interns go nights without sleeping, haze them, basically, treat them very badly, and then when they are new and inexperienced and turn them out on people in hospitals, usually people who don't have money to pay, to experiment on, to work on while they are suffering from lack of sleep, and it's so medically unsound. It is so obviously malpractice, bad practice. And yet it became like a click, like a social thing you don't talk about. You just let them do it. And I remember thinking, why? What is the... Why does no one speak up against this? Why is this not obviously dysfunctional? And that's when I was quite young, I realized that's the problem with everything, is we're dysfunctional. And I tried to figure out, why are we dysfunctional? Why do we lie? Why do we not do what's good? Why do people even like what's evil? Why do people get this, you know, you see it in all the bad movies, people gloating over doing something cruel or evil. Why? It's so sick. It's so unhealthy. It's so nauseating. It's pathetic. It's sad. It's deranged. Why would we want that? And I realized it took me a long time to figure that, because I saw people doing it. But to me, it made no sense. Like, the attraction of evil or doing something, quote, bad. Like, sex is another one. You do what's naughty. Naughty? Why not do what's wonderful? There's a, this is a quote I've been wanting to get in here, and I just see it, and it's, I'm actually getting it from a book called Annam Cara, a book of Celtic wisdom by John O'Donohoe, or Donahue, I'm not sure how he pronounces it, but he has a quote from Pablo Neruda, who wrote this beautiful part of a poem, and it's a phrase I love. It says, I want to do with you what spring does with the cherry trees. Now there's the energetic love. That's the power of the love. And if we wanted to do that in sex, if we wanted to do that in friendship, if we wanted to do that in taking care of our babies and our children and in schools when we taught them, if we wanted to create an energy that allowed spring to bloom, to allow the nascent, inherent life force and beauty and wisdom of each child, we're talking about school and teaching, if we let it just be acknowledged in the sense of feeling it, not talking about it, because that's one step removed. It's kind of like killing it, but just living it. This is the frustration I have, that so much of my work has been really plagiarized and used, because the words are there, but then none of the spirit is in it. It's all strutting across the stage and writing books and making millions, but not living it. And we desperately need the exemplars. We desperately need the feeling of living it, because it's tender. And it is going to be a collective process. We're all going to do it, you know, one way or another, sometime or another. And I just want to squeeze in, maybe it should be at the end, but I never know how far it'll take me. There was a quote I have in this Annam Cara given our subject, you know what to do with truth when it's inconvenient or unkind. And even, what's the difference between inconvenient and unkind? Now, sometimes we have real trouble telling the difference. The kindness and the goodwill is what lets you know. That's what guides you automatically, almost without having to intellectually think about it. It's a state of approach that the new thoughts are conceived behind and come filtering through. So you don't have to use your will to be kind. You just have to use your will to move to the state of goodwill, of letting go. Use your will to let go of the judgmental trap, of the hate, of the blame, of the when you find yourself polarizing against somebody, or even just wanting to nail them for what they're doing wrong. It's very important to say what's wrong. I'm a very big believer, as you know, in talking about what is going on so things don't remain this, you know, inconvenient truth. And Al Gore quotes Upton Sinclair, who said, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. And, of course, we have a huge amount of that, and not only your salary, but whether you will be allowed to belong. Kids go through this as teenagers, kids that are left abandoned by our society and not loved and are on the streets, exposed to crime and danger, join gangs to keep create some kind of cohesiveness. And it's somewhat the Lord of the Flies dysfunctional because there's no warmth there. There's no collective warmth. We're not loving them. All we want to do is put them in prison or kill them. We don't like them, but we don't see they're our children. We don't see they're just people who are wounded. But this little bit I wanted to talk to you about out of Anamkara, a book of Celtic wisdom. It's published by Cliff Street Books, HarperCollins. And he talks about the wounded gift. And that the great powers of love, the great power of love is to bring balance. And it brings balance because it helps us move towards transfiguration. This is exactly what I've been talking about. We are transformed. So when two people come together with a recognition of one another, there is this deep capacity towards transfiguration because we will let love be the state. The approach. And he says, when you really love someone, you shine the light of your soul on the beloved. We know from nature that sunlight brings everything to growth. If you look at flowers early on a spring morning, they are all closed. When the light of the sun catches them, they trustingly open out and give themselves to the new light. When you love someone who is very hurt, one of the worst things you can do is to directly address the hurt and make an issue of it. A strange dynamic comes alive in the soul if you make something into an issue. It's not too strange, really. The reason why, if you are nailing something, you're making it an issue. You don't have comprehension and healing about it. You just see that it's not okay. And you're really functioning from the position of being right. And as soon as you function from the position of being right, defensiveness is caused to come into being. It's right, that immature energy calls to the immature energy. And I, many years ago, invented something I call matching energy. And what it is when you know that there is energy between people, all the time, and in the emotional terms and in psychological terms and in even intellectual terms, when you recognize that you're matching energy with someone, you have the power to choose a high form of energy. So if somebody says something nasty to you, you can come out to them with a nasty response. You won't like them. They won't feel good to you. You will find something wrong with them and say, oh, yeah, and let them have it back. If you are mature and you're working at transforming energy and they say something nasty to you, if you don't match energy with it and you instead see this person is dysfunctional, this person is injured, this person feels inadequate, this person doesn't understand what they're it's amazing what will come to your mind to say. Sometimes you'll say nothing. Sometimes you'll walk away. Sometimes you'll give them a look and go, what? Excuse me? Say that again. And then you say that with such neutralness, such love, such not matching energy with what they're anticipating, which is sort of what makes them feel alive. They send out back and they get back and they say, see, I need to be back because that comes at me. And that's what matching energy does. But it also does it with love. So if you send love to someone, goodwill, respect, then what happens is the respect comes back. It's sometimes grudgingly, sometimes later, sometimes immediately, sometimes almost in a way of being stunned, and the person changes their position about you right away. It's quite awesome, this power of matching energy, and I believe it's what Jesus was trying to, or maybe he wasn't trying, he was teaching, but people tried to interpret it not too well, is love your enemy. And if you love your enemy, then you don't have an enemy anymore. But turning the other cheek didn't mean be a doormat. It didn't mean just set yourself up to be a victim and get hit again. It meant don't strike back. And when you understand this dynamic of matching energy, you actually can put the light of transfiguration on it. You can put the light of healing on it. This is our awesome power. This is the essence of the evolutionary leap. This is the essence of living on the growing edge and the power that guides us through it. And this is what it means to become whole and to become the next level of human. So, getting back to John O'Donohoe, he says, a strange dynamic comes alive in the soul if you make something into an issue. It becomes a habit and keeps a current pattern. Frequently, it's better simply to acknowledge that there's a wound there, but then stay away from it. Every chance you get, shine the gentle light of the soul in on the wound. It's helpful to remember that there are ancient resources of renewal and refreshment in the circle of love that brings and holds you both together. The destiny of your love is never dependent merely on the fragile resources of your separate subjectivities. You can invoke the healing of the third force of light between you. This can bring forgiveness, consolation, and healing in many stony times. And this is the power. This is the next level of being. I must say that in all my reading, I haven't read a whole lot because I read synchronistically. There's a lot of things I actually dislike reading. So full of good stuff mixed with garbage that it frustrates me. But this book is the nicest book. It's the most loving book. And I like it very much because he's obviously truly, genuinely aware of the place. He's not just saying nice words that he's lifted from someone else or from even an ancient tradition, though he's describing that. He is living it. And that's how you transform the world, is you live it. You have to believe it. So belief is not having a bunch of nouns, articles, particles, words, ideologies, rules, dogmas in your head and say, I believe, because I believe this dogma and I believe this ideology. That's not believing. Believing in God and believing in spirit is mystical transfiguration, and it's a believing of it. You believe it, and when you believe it, you are believing God. You're believing it with a capital I. You are believing the flow of the universe. You're believing the goodness, and that's our choice, and that's our power. That's the thing we always are able to choose to do. And that's why it is our creation and why the evolutionary leap is in our hands to actually live this, to actually do it, and to be it. And it's wonderful that the words are more prominently out there and don't sound so strange anymore. But it's time for the earnestness of being authentic and kind at the same time. And interestingly, authentic and kind coexist when you are in that transfiguring energy of love. integrate the two hemispheres of the brain and the body and help this whole transfiguration proceed and unravel and unfold and heal. But when I make those sounds at the end, I always say something that came to me many years ago that I then saw in a book from the Upanishads, almost identical words. And so it makes you know you really are connected to that bigger circle of consciousness, of a bigger whole of energy, and that when you come to it from your own pioneering, you have made the mistakes, you have a deep comprehension of it, much more than when you just copy words and say them, no matter how wonderful the words are. So this transfiguration place, after I make the sounds, there was a quote from, it's my quote, my intuition's quote, I don't know how to claim it or say that, and very similar to the Upanishads, the presence of God vibrates within you, and it radiates from you as you. So there is a miracle of transformation when you surrender and align with what's wholesome in everyday doing, everyday things, and certainly in human interactions where things get the most defended, relationships, sexuality, healing, teaching, just being a fellow human in the living moment. That transfiguration, that transformation is simple, yet awesome and powerful. And of course, what it is love. But love lived. The presence, the capital P, felt. And when we're angry and hurt, and we say, okay, I'm hurt because something has violated me, what can I do to heal myself? What transformance? I don't need any agreement from anybody else. What way of holding this? And let yourself go to sleep with that inspiration in your mind and see what your dreams will give you and see what the morning will bring. Or maybe when the next time you forget all about it and the next time you're in the midst of an argument or a problem, a feeling will flood up, an image will come up, and it will be the gift. It will be the creative choice, the other way, the transformation. So I know our time is coming to an end. I want to really recommend you all see An Inconvenient Truth and bring as many friends and neighbors as you can, especially young people. Not for despair, but for knowledge, for wisdom, to be armed and strengthened to know the power of this moment and where we are and how collectively connected we are and how much good we can all do. I send you all love, many blessings, and until next week, this is Trust the Problem, and I'm Patricia Sun.
You've been listening to Trust the Problem with Patricia Sun. This program and its content is copywritten to Patricia Sun, all rights reserved, 2006.